This is Phil Farron. And I am driving home. It's Thursday today. I think I'm done for the week unless something comes up tomorrow. We did have a little something come up this morning. There was a piece of information that was pushed across to us last night, and if you would have asked me yesterday if I had accounted for that, I would have told you yes. And if I had gone and looked at the SQL Server code and pulled the code up and looked at the code, I would have told you, yes, that is taken care of. Turns out it wasn't taken care of. So we blew up last night. Not literally. So that's okay. We got in this morning. We figured out what the problem was. Took care of the problem. Reran the processes that were supposed to run last night. Takes us about 2 hours to get through everything. Got through everything. Everything was balanced. Yay! So happy when everything is balanced to the penny. Love that. Love that. It is episode 217. It's been a good week. We've actually had some relatives in town. It's been good to see them. Had a very nice experience. When was it? Saturday and Sunday, I think. When I had gotten to the end of Grumpy Old Prophets and I was doing book four, it was a little bit of a struggle to find people at that point, because it's like part five, you know, and people are like, I don't want to jump in now. But I was amazed. I had sent out an email to people who had been beta readers in the past and had already read Amanda and the Skleberry Tree. So I sent out an email and got just some real positive response back. Yes, yes, I want to read that book. Oh, yay, it's back. Been waiting for this book, you know. So that's always heartening for an author, that people are excited about a continuation of a story. And so I'd picked up, I don't know, 15, 20, somewhere in there, just from my previous beta readers. And so I had 15 or 20 to go. I can't remember exactly where. By the time I actually put up the notice, I think I had about 15. So I put up a notice on Facebook. My wife echoed it to her page as well. And I put it up Saturday. She echoed it. I think it was Sunday morning, and I had everybody. So it just went bang, 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 bang. And some people, I asked my wife about a couple of them. I said, do you know so-and-so? And she said, no. So, I mean, there's a couple of people that I don't even know who they are or where they came from, but somehow they found out about it, which is just fine. I'm always interested in getting spread out to new people. I have my 40 beta readers. I actually have more than 40 beta readers. I think it's 42 or 43. 42, I think. I have enough that all of the books are spoken for at this point. Well, that's not true. I may have one extra. I need to check with a guy who I can't remember whether he actually told me that he was wanting to be a beta reader or not. But anyways, so they're out. My job tonight is to get them packaged up and to get the postage purchased for them, and then take them to the post office tomorrow and, you know, dump them in the post office and then come back home and start on book three. And that will be Amanda and the Cog Shifting Imp. And that probably would be the last one that I'm going to do on this series for a while. Although people really like... They really seem to like this series. If I get the kind of response to this book that I got to the last book, it's kind of hard to walk away from that when people are so excited about the... I mean, everybody who got back to me with Amanda and the Skleberry Tree, they all loved that book. So, I don't know. Is that true, everybody? I think most. I will say everybody. That is our story. Anyways, so that's all gone well. Just have a few little cleanup to do there. The ideas are starting to percolate now for the third book. So interesting. It's just so interesting. Because it's all kind of just like a fog. And then all of a sudden you'll get a little, oh yeah, I could do that. And, oh yeah, I could tie that back in. Oh yeah, that's right. I could tie that back in. And so the little pieces, all those little pieces start forming up. And the story begins. Fun, fun stuff. Anyways, I have several articles in queue at this point to talk about. And so I was looking through my list yesterday, trying to figure out... which, by the way, also, as far as the Knit Clips stuff goes, I still haven't done anything with that. I've been busy... trying to get this book finished up and get the beta copies put out, and it's just been like, well, it's not hurting anything to sit there, so I'm just going to let it sit there. I may make a decision. Sorry. This next week, but we just had enough stuff going that I didn't want to bother with it. So, on YouTube, I still have a banned video, which I may do something about that this weekend. I'll see. This week, maybe, I don't know. Anyways, in my list of articles I was going over, I did come across an article that I remembered bookmarking, and I thought, oh yeah, that's an interesting article. And then I started reading it, and it was a long article. Started reading it last night, and I was like, not sure. And then I hit one paragraph and I was like, oh, that's pretty interesting. And then I hit another paragraph, that's kind of interesting too. By the time I was done, I thought, yeah, sure, we're talking about this. Well, then I get it copied over to make some notes, and it's a lot more pages of notes than I thought it was going to be. And then I started going through and marking stuff up. And typically what I do is I dump it in at like 14. So it's, 12 or 14 point type so that it's there. And then anything that I want to talk about, I take up to like 20 point type and just bold it. So I can read the smaller stuff by glancing at it if I've got an idea of what's there. And then, you know, I definitely can glance at the bold stuff and pick it up pretty quickly. And so I ended up with enough bold stuff that it actually went to like 22 or 23 pages of notes, which is far longer than I've ever done before. So there's no way I'm getting through all this, but at least we can kind of get the gist of it. And I'm going to tell you right up front, this research is not done yet. There's still a lot of research to do on it, but there's some pretty fascinating suggestions already in it, and pretty interesting things from a design viewpoint, from a biological design viewpoint. So anyways, the article was by Michael Poulin? Poulin, P-O-L-L-O-N, I'm not sure I've spelled that right. He's written a lot of books on nutrition and food. I have read several of his books, very good books. His latest book, and I will probably download it and read it at some point, is called Cooked, A Natural History of Transformation. And as I understand it, it's all about the evolution, the change in food, and the years and years of development that have gone into real food, fruits, vegetables, those kinds of things, versus what we, a lot of us, are feeding ourselves at this point. So it sounds like it's a very interesting book. The article, I don't believe, is what that book is talking about. The article is really talking about something that I have mentioned in the past. And that is that the current estimates are that if you add up all the genetic material that is uniquely human that we carry around with us, and then you add up all the genetic material for all of the bacteria and viruses and whatever else that we carry around with us, we are in fact outnumbered 10 to 1. Because there's so much bacteria that we carry around in our skin and in our mouth and in our gut and in other various sundry places, that it vastly outnumbers what we would be called, what we would call humans. Human. And so the article, in this article, Michael Pollan was talking about his reaction to the latest research on this. And the name of the article is "Some of My Best Friends Are Germs." And it's interesting because he talks about the start of the article, he talks about the exact date when he began to think of himself in the, he calls it the first person plural, when he began to think about himself as a, quote, super organism. That is, rather than a plain old individual human being. He said it was on March 7th, I guess, of this year, and he had received his packet from the Biofrontiers Institute at the University of Colorado in Boulder. They have a citizen science initiative called American Gut Project. And if they actually let anybody do this, I've got to get on the web tonight and find out. I may send off for this because this is fascinating. The lab had sequenced his microbiome, the genes of not him, but of the several hundred microbial species that he shares with his, in his body, that he shares his body with. And he quotes the figure in here. He said, these bacteria, which number around 100 trillion, are living and dying right now on his skin and his tongue, blah, 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 blah. And he said, as it turns out, and I've heard this figure before, he said, as it turns out, we are only 10% human. That for every human cell that is intrinsic to our body, there are about 10 resident microbes. Now, what's interesting about all of this is that they group them into commensurals, generally harmless freeloaders, mutuals, favor traders, where they help us and we help them. And he said there's really only a tiny number of cases of pathogens. And so we are this giant community that has reached this, not in his term, but this state of peace, in my term, where we're helping each other out. And in fact, the newest research, this is where it started to get really interesting, because the newest research is telling us that the health of these communities, specifically the health of the communities that we carry around in our intestinal systems, really is important. And that the food we eat, we should consider what we're eating not just on the basis of what nutrients it supplies our human cells, but we should consider it from the basis of supplying our microbial passengers. Let's put it that way. that we would do well to consider the impact that our eating is having on these microbial passengers. I said because some people are believing, some scientists are beginning to think now that this uptick that we're having in autoimmune diseases like Crohn's and those types of things are directly related to the fact that that the microbes in our gut are being affected by what we are eating. And so that was pretty interesting. One of the ways that they start talking about this now is that they start talking about the fact that human health should now be thought of as a collective property of human-associated microbiota. He said that some of the people are coming to the conclusion that for the past century, we've been doing our unwitting best to wreck the human-associated microbiota with a multi-fronted war on bacteria and a diet notably detrimental to its well-being. Because he talks about all those food additives and things that I was talking about last week, while there has been very little research on what it actually does to the human body, there's been zero research on what it does to the bacteria in our digestive tracts. And some people are starting to think that some of the associated risk problems that we have, including metabolic syndrome, which is the precursor to diabetes, stage 2 adult onset diabetes, that it may be that yes, we are overtaxing our insulin-producing systems, but it may be that this community of bacteria is actually part of what helps us in the insulin process, and by damaging that, you cause problems. They were saying that there's been work done on fecal transplants, and it's just what it sounds like. They basically take poop out of one person's intestine and put it into another, or out of one animal's intestine and put it into another. And it's been shown that if you have, like, a mouse that is insulin resistant, that's having trouble with absorption of nutrients and things because they have metabolic syndrome, that you can take fecal matter out of a mouse that is healthy and transplant it, and there's a dramatic boost in the effectiveness of the insulin, I believe, or the insulin production, something. Anyways, there is an obvious improvement where it doesn't seem like there should be an obvious improvement, because you're introducing something that isn't technically a part of that body, but there's some sort of relationship there. One of the other interesting things that came out of this article is he was saying that for years, nutrition scientists were confounded by the presence in human breast milk of certain complex carbohydrates, and he named them, but I'm not going to try that. He said, which the human infant lacks the necessary enzymes to digest. So why this really bothered the nutritional scientist is because human breast milk, you would think that from an evolutionary perspective, that this was just about the most perfectly designed human food. Because evolution has had a long time to figure out, you know, what should be that food. And yet, it has these complex carbohydrates in it that it's been shown that human infants do not have the capability of digesting those. So, So what's going on? And scientists think they know now what's going on, that in fact, those components helped nurture and help promote a certain type of bacteria in the child's stomach, in the infant's digestional system. And the fact that that particular bacteria is flourishing means it gets a toehold and keeps other less beneficial bacteria from flourishing. So, you know, whether or not you want to say, okay, well, that's, you know, that's the result of evolution or design or whatever, the fact of the matter is that it makes sense. Oh, da-da-da-da! I get a really good deal on some Vibram shoes, and they just came in today, and that's the new deed. We have the new deed on our property. I'd mentioned that I bought out my buddy. Anyways, so it's really interesting that apparently from the get-go, from the first sip that an infant gets of its mother's milk, his or her mother's milk, let's put it that way, the system is designed to help the formation and to prosper the formation of these colonies of bacteria that we carry around with us. The other thing that was interesting in here, let me flip the pages here. Oh, I've heard this before, and this was pretty interesting, that there's a difference between having a child using a C-section and having a child delivered vaginally. That if the child is delivered vaginally, they are exposed to a whole host of other different bacterias as they're being delivered than if they're being delivered in C-section style, where, you know, they swab the woman all up and try to keep it disinfected. And that, in fact, that it's much better for the child to be delivered vaginally. And the author of this article was talking to one of these microbiologist scientists, and they said that they were sufficiently concerned about this that his wife was going to have a C-section because of the situation of the birth, and that he and his wife took matters into their own hands using a sterile cotton swab. They inoculated the newborn's skin with the mother's vaginal secretions to ensure a proper colonization. I mean, there's all these things that are built into the system that are really interesting. Now, I told you this was early, and it is. It's still early. They can do the analysis and tell you what type of colonies you have living on you, but they're not really sure what a healthy one should look like yet. And they're trying to go like into areas of the Amazon and find people that are living right next to the dirt and, you know, have never been exposed to antibiotics and things, and take samples and see the difference between them. And they're saying that that the Western diet has knocked out a lot of what you would expect to find in a natural setting. And they're not really sure whether that's good or bad. And he went through some high levels of certain types of bacteria that the people who eat plant-based foods have versus the people who eat processed foods. And that was all pretty interesting. And he was talking about the fact that he had to have a round of antibiotics because he was having some dental surgery, and he actually got swabbed before and after, and it just decimated. He was pretty happy. One of his levels was high because he does eat a lot of plant-based nutrition and those kind of things. And then after this, these antibiotics had just decimated that. And he actually had a bloom of bacteria that were either less beneficial or not beneficial. And some of the scientists were going, wow, that's really interesting. But, you know, they assured him that as he kept on a plant-based diet and stuff, that he could get his other levels back up, even though at this point they're not, you know, they're not really sure. They do think, I'm quoting out of the article, that our gut bacteria also play a role in the manufacture of substance like neurotransmitters, including serotonin, enzymes and vitamins, notably Bs and Ks, and other essential nutrients, including the important amino acid and short-chain fatty acids, and a suite of other signaling molecules that talk to and influence the immune and metabolic systems. In other words, you need a healthy community because that healthy community is going to influence all of these other things. Things that are going to affect your brain, things that are going to affect your body, things that are going to affect your appetite. It's really, really interesting. One of the other interesting things they came across, and then I'll wrap it up with this. Well, they had actually a few suggestions in the back, and I'll pass those along. The other thing that's interesting about this is this has caused some of these scientists to say, why would evolution do this? Which, of course, you know, when they say, why does evolution do this? I always think, well, why did God design it this way? But that's okay, you know. Because I've told you before, wherever someone says that this, you know, evolution did this or this evolved this way or that was done this way because of evolution, I just substitute design for adaptation in there. You know, this was designed for adaptation because of this. You know, this ended up this way because it was designed for adaptation. But one of the questions they were asking themselves is, okay, well, why would we end up this way where we would be carrying this host of bacteria around with us? Why didn't we just evolve our own systems for producing all these chemicals and doing all this kind of stuff? And they made a really interesting point, and that is that bacteria can adapt, i.e. evolve, very rapidly because of their lifestyle and life cycle. And so when you get into changing conditions and your diet changes drastically and you're in different environments, bacteria, some of them die off, some of them adapt. You, in essence, have a container that adapts slowly, but then you have an energy system internally that adapts rapidly to changes. And I thought, wow, that actually is pretty cool. It really is very, very cool. Anyways, the article had a lot of really good stuff on it. Went on and on and on and on and on and on and on. But it was good. It was good. It was good. It was good. He did have some suggestions at the end. And again, nobody knows exactly what the suggestions are, best suggestions are at this point. Because nobody knows exactly what all this is doing or how important it is or what recommendations should be made. But here's some things that is interesting. He says one theory is that the problem. Sorry. That's not what I was looking for. Okay. I was looking for the place where he was saying, yes, fiber is good. Make sure you get fiber because that's important to your lower intestine. But there's different kinds of fiber they were talking about. They were kind of big on fermented foods, by the way. Sauerkraut, kimchi, yogurt. But they were saying that the fermentation that's going on in your large intestine, that's really, they think right now that that's pretty cool. Here it is. But it turns out that one of the keys to health is fermentation in the large intestine. And the key to feeding the fermentation in the large intestine is giving it lots of plants with various types of fiber, including resistant starch found in bananas, oats, and beans, soluble fibers in onions and other root vegetables and nuts, and insoluble fibers in whole grains, especially bran and avocados. So I got most of those things on that list that I'm eating. So that's why I'd like to take this test and just kind of see where I'm at, how I look, and all that kind of stuff. Some people I know find this discussion off-putting, but this is really fascinating because this is the machine that we are. And I think we ignore the machine that we are at our peril because our existence here is all bound up in our physicality. You know, it is true that we are more than just our physicality, but our physicality has a huge impact on the quality of our life. And so whatever we can do to assist the functioning of our body and to assist it functioning well, I think is time well spent and focus well spent. This is Phil Ferrand, and I have made it home.